you know, I always read Romans 13 and I just didn't understand where he's saying, obey the authorities and you'll receive praise of the same. And I just had this picture of, you know, a cop pulling you over and telling you, you know, you did such a great job back there. You know, I was clocking you and you were going the speed limit and I just wanted to tell you, thanks, you know, keep going. And that just never happens, does right. it? You know, right. But what does happen is if we as a collective are bringing the fruit, the overflow of this kingdom of grace into our neighborhoods and our cities, so that people are like, you know, I don't know who those people are, but I'm glad they're here. You know, they just cleaned up that park, you know, or whatever. But they're seen as people who contribute to the well-being. They're not troublemakers. They aren't making life hard for those around them.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we are seeking to recover faith by recovering the faith. I'm Kent.
I'm Nathan.
And we're in a series called Redefining Faith. And last night, I was talking with someone about our topic for today. Our topic for today is the church. And I was with some people, and they were saying, one of the guys was talking about why they chose the church they did. And he said, well, first of all, there's only two churches in this town that have youth programs that you want your kids to go to. So, like, first of all, you're knowing, okay, he's got, like, maybe hundreds to choose from. And then, from his point of view, there's only two that really have youth programs, okay? And then he goes on to say that then it was a matter of whether we wanted to go to the one that had the 9 o'clock service or the 9:30 service. And they decided that they can't make 9 a.m., so they chose the one with the 9:30 service. So that's how they chose church. Maybe they'll be blessed there and they'll have a great experience, but it was just clearly a consumeristic way of choosing church and thinking about church. Let's, you know, consume the programs that they offer and pick the one that has the time of meeting that works for you. So I thought that's relevant to today's discussion, because what we're trying to do in this series is deconstruct cultural assumptions, cultural ideas, received cultural ideas about Christianity, and reconstruct something that's more faithful. Okay? So, here is the steeple. Here is the steeple. That's the title for today's talk.
I was like, what?
Where? And the misconception is that the church is an institution tasked with presiding over worship ceremonies, maturing Christians, doing good in Jesus' name, and spreading the gospel. And the reconstruction is, the church is the Israel of God. What? That's weird. A people called out of the world to offer true worship to God and to demonstrate his glory before the surrounding society.
Okay.
Yeah. Nathan, you wrote that. Tell us why you wrote that.
I did write that. And that was been a couple of years ago, probably. Why did I write that? You know, I was really struck with this this idea, the continuity between the church and Israel. There are some places where Paul pronounces, like in Galatians 6, he says, for in Christ, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything. And so now he's mucking around in the identity of Israel. He says, but a new creature. And as many who live by this rule, on them be peace and mercy, I think, and on the Israel of God. Mm-hmm. So he's very clearly saying that there's an Israel, physical Israel, and then there's what he would call the Israel of God. Mm-hmm. And he speaks, you know, in Romans, for instance, we get what I've always thought was a parenthetical in Romans 9 through 11, this excursus into Israel, where he's, you know, I wish that I myself could be accursed for the sake of my countrymen, for, you know, physical Israel. And he goes on and begins to unpack this idea of how God hasn't abandoned Israel. He has this plan for Israel. And we think in terms of this physical nation, it's in a geographical location. And yet, you know, when he gets to the end of chapter 11 in this parenthetical, he says, and so all Israel shall be saved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're like, wait, you know, because we know, I mean, he's already said, I wish that they could be saved. Mm-hmm. And then he says they can't be because they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge in chapter 10. Mm-hmm. So in chapter 9 and chapter 10, he's saying many of people who are of Israeli descent, Jewish descent, are not going to be saved. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to the end of chapter 11, and he says all Israel will be saved.
Because he's saying the Jews, the Gentiles are coming in, and that's going to make some of the Jews jealous, and they're going to come in, and so all Israel will be saved.
Right.
Meaning it's a Gentile and Jew thing. It's right. The church is, the church is the Israel of God.
Right, right. And so there's this elect that he speaks of, those who God foreknew and so has chosen. So he's making this case that God has chosen a people, but he's chosen them based on his foreknowledge. And those people are not necessarily of Abrahamic descent physically. They're of Abrahamic descent spiritually. Mm-hmm. And that spiritual lineage is connected by this thing he calls faith.
Mm-hmm. Those who are of the faith of Abraham is something right. he says earlier in Romans, maybe Romans 4.
Right, right. And so that's all Israel for Paul. Those who have that sort of faith, those that God foreknew. And when God spoke to Abraham and promised him this, that he would be a great nation and also that he would be the father of many nations, mm-hmm. speaks to this idea that it's a nation made up of many nations. Yeah. And it's not even a nation made up of a bunch of immigrants who have naturalized and assimilated. You know, these are people who retain their national identity, or it wouldn't make any sense to mm-hmm. say you're father of many nations. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that is this overarching plan in Paul's mind. So when Paul is talking about the church, it's not a parenthetical in Romans 9 through 11. There's continuity all the way through. Mm-hmm. He's really been pointing out that the distinction between those who are the called out, which is what church means, you know, this assembly that's called together, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we get in Acts 7, Stephen, and you may not see it in newer translations, but as Stephen is speaking of the nation in the wilderness, he uses the word church. He says that, you know, that God was with the church in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. So this idea of being called out, what is it to be church? It just means that you are part of this Abrahamic tradition. You know, mm-hmm. God says to Abraham, leave your family, you know, and your land and go to a place I'll show you. There's a calling. Mm-hmm. Israel called out of Egypt. And so God, when he calls them out, he gives them this mission statement, what he really wants, right? Why does he call these people out? So that they will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. We talked about this on previous episodes. In Exodus 19, in my belief, is there we have what I would say is the eternal vision statement, you know, the mission for the church. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, we like to put together mission statements, and usually probably the most popular approach, and one that I would say has been effective in building large churches, is to take the Great Commission, the Great Commandment, fuse them together, and so you get something like loving God, loving people, make disciples, and, you know, love God, love each other. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of things become the mission statement for the church. But why those random verses, you know, those random passages? I'm not saying that they're necessarily wrong, but it is kind of an approach where we we pluck out verses that are particularly compelling and we decide those are going to be what we're going to make the mission statement of this church. Mm-hmm. Where
are you saying, though, but there's actually some verses in the Bible that are some different verses that are actually written as God's mission statement for his church?
Right, right. So if he calls people out and he says, here's what you're going to be, mm-hmm. you know, then we probably should pay attention.
We should try to be that. That right. should be our mission statement.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah. And so the problem is that we don't see this continuity between Israel and the church. And I'm not saying that somehow God has flipped or he's changed his notion of what is Israel, that, you know, Paul would say God has always had this vision for Israel.
Uh-huh.
And that we are Israel. And so
his people, his right, called out ones.
Right.
Right. His called out people.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Which is why we get, and I think we mentioned this a few weeks ago, we get this, what almost seems like an apparent contradiction, where he calls us to love our neighbor and he calls us to love our brother.
Uh-huh.
And which one is it? And I really prefer the love your brother. It just gives me a smaller set of people to have to keep up with. You know, love your neighbor could be anybody, especially if you, you know, go with the Good Samaritan story. Mm-hmm. But I think in Paul's concept that your brother is your neighbor, in that those who are in the family of God are in the nation of God, and the nation of God is Israel, and Israel is the church.
Mm-hmm.
So we are called to live with our brother as fellow citizens in this society that God is creating, that is the church. So how is that different from the model of church that we get? What do you think?
Well, you're talking about there? God is praised by our welcoming one another. Like as God has welcomed us, we welcome those who are different from us. Mm-hmm. We treat them as family and as neighbor, one and the same, in overlapping concepts, metaphors. So this somewhere in the Old Testament, you know, where God called out Israel, he said, you're going to be my people for my praise. You're going to worship me.
Yes.
And so we worship God as this multicultural, multi-ethnic, multinational community.
Right.
In Christ.
Right. Right. So it's essentially participatory. This vision is necessarily participatory, like God does later. You know, he gives the Levitical priesthood, but you know, I really do think that was kind of a necessity. It's a sin management approach, whereas now that Christ has come, who is descended from the tribe of Judah, right, that there's this kingdom and priest, that this priestly kingdom that has come to fruition, that's in fullness. And so where the Levitical system used maybe more of a quarantine approach. So there's, if you imagine sin as being a disease, right? And how do you manage a disease for which there's no cure? You have to try to limit the spread.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It sounds familiar, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And yet once we find an intervention, a cure, then the approach switches from restriction management to propagation,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. to mm-hmm. get mm-hmm. the shot, right? To mass advertising, availability, distribution.
Okay, I thought you were saying propagation as in we have like a new disease and we're seeking to propagate it.
That's true.
Like, so you're like flipping it.
Yeah, that's true as well. But I
but God, now we have a cure.
Right. So we have a cure. It's about distribution of the cure, not quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
So those who are healthy now have, it's incumbent on them to go out among those, mm-hmm. you know, who are sick. Whereas previously there was a need to make a firm partition between the healthy and the sick.
Mm-hmm.
Now there is an insistence and a injunction, a requirement that the health go out into the sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And so now there's a priesthood, but it's not this cordoned off class. You know, it's not about curtains and clothing and restrictions. It's about a difference in lifestyle. And so these people who now, this nation, you know, we are the priests of God. But that priesthood ultimately is about revealing God to humankind. You know, we often think of priesthood as offering sacrifices to God, and it is. But it's also about demonstrating who God is, being the go-between with between God, the intermediary between God and humankind and the rest of the world. So when God says, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I really think that Paul resumes that concept in Romans 12. So Romans 9 through 11 fits naturally and just goes straight into Romans 12. So Romans 11, Paul has come to the end of what we would call his excursus on Israel. And he's talked about how the Gentiles are grafted into this vine, you know, that God has cultivated. And and he ends that chapter with this doxology, this praise to God and all of his wonders and how he has worked out his plan. But then he gets to chapter 12 and he says, therefore, in view of God's mercies. Mm-hmm. So this isn't a break, right?
Yeah, yeah. In response to what I've just described as God's overarching plan.
Right.
Now you go do what? And then he's sharing this vision of hospitality and serving one another, loving one another, honoring one another, taking care of one another.
Yeah.
So it's this mutual love, which is the church.
Yes.
His vision for the church. That's how we worship God as God's called out people.
Exactly.
And that's different than choosing a church based on what time their worship services are and what kind of youth programs they offer. Right? That's kind of treating the pastors and preachers as the priests who offer services and they perform ceremonies for our benefit. And instead, we're the priests,
right,
is what you're saying. We are the priesthood.
Right, yeah.
And we're here for one another and for God and for the world.
Right, yeah. We see church as, I don't even know what it would be analogous to in our world. Maybe a hospital. You know, and we say the church is more like a hospital than a hotel or something. But we would definitely see it as a place where there are professionals there who are offering goods and services for a fee. Mm-hmm. And that, so when we go, that there's this implicit agreement, contract, that if you go there, they're going to offer goods and services that meet your expectations or some need that you have sufficiently. And if that's the case, then you will return, right? Mm-hmm. And that you will leave them a positive rating on Google or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And that you will give whatever amount of money that is maybe the expected norm for your culture and, whatever. Or at least you'll have excuses for not. So that seems very different. Maybe for somebody that's like, oh, yeah, that's exactly the same vision. But I don't see that. And I don't know. I'm probably naive in trying to even talk about doing things differently. I'm kind of a ideologue. Because unfortunately in our society, this has become so accepted that churches that don't play the game don't exist. Mm-hmm. There's very much just a natural selection so that if you put the onus back on your members and you say, no, actually, you know, we don't have a minimum amount to give. Mm-hmm. The amount to give is determined by the need of the people in the room, you know, or a part of the group. And that sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes it's everything. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't tell you that. But we do know that you're responsible for them and their well-being, and that God is glorified and praised. And the reason that we're here is to come to one another as a priest and bring an offering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's difficult to sell when compared with, you know, we want 3% of your income on a regular basis, and we're going to provide X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you don't have to be around people that you don't find pleasant. You can find people who are very much like you because we have this, you know, we have 2,000 people on a Sunday morning, and of those 2,000 people, there's 100 that are just like you.
And sometimes you groups are even formed around the idea of affinity. They're called affinity groups.
Right. Well, and small groups can be that. You know, in a church that has a self-celebration model, everybody gets what they want. The church is large enough to provide the goods and services that somebody wants on a Sunday morning or for their children or whatever. So it can be a high quality worship experience with very, you know, pleasant music and stuff. But, you know, here's what I would challenge our listeners to do is to, if you go to a larger church, or let's say you visit one or whatever, and, the worship, you know, a song is played and people are, singing, or they're not, they're listening or whatever it is they're doing. When that song comes to an end, what do people instinctively do? Do you know? Have you ever noticed? I don't know if it happens in every church. Mm-mm. In many churches, people clap. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, why are we clapping? Maybe I'm just being too critical. But I have to ask.
Clapping for the performance.
Yeah.
The musical performance.
Yeah. Why do we do that? You know? And people, oh, you know, hey, give God a round of applause. Is that why we clap? Did we start with clapping? You know, did we clap at other random intervals? Is God not quite as good, you know, in certain parts of the thing? You know, hey, I get it. You know, I've actually delivered a sermon before, and people instinctively broke out in applause. And this wasn't even the tradition of this church. They never did. But I don't know. Obviously, I was just too much of a showman or something. But people kind of do that. Mm-hmm. And I just, what does that suggest if we as a collective sitting out there feel this impulse to the point that we, as a group, respond in this way that in our society says, you know, It's a way of affirming and expressing gratitude for a pleasing performance. Why do we do that? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think your implication is that we're responding to the performance and celebrating good job, professionals.
Yeah.
You know, you've offered a service that pleases me.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I can't think of why else we would. I mean,
some general sense of euphoria, like this is exciting, yeah, and I'm excited about God and this church and this is so great.
Right. Yeah. And I'm, you know, it could be a lot of things. And I'm sure if you interviewed people and said, hey, what are you doing? Why are you clapping? You know, they would come up with a good, you know, a reason other than, I don't know, that was just a really good performance, you know, but it does speak to this unidirectional approach to ministry where somebody who's uniquely qualified is the one who does the ministry and everybody else is there as the audience. Mm-hmm. We even call them the audience. Mm-hmm. We put them in an auditorium. Mm-hmm. Where audiences are.
Yeah, and that's our way of doing church now. We call it church.
Yeah.
It's really more like this worship concert. Maybe you could call it a worship service. We certainly call them worship services. But your point is that we have a different worship service calling. And I think actually you've said our service to one another is our worship.
Yes. Right, right. And so that gets to Romans 12. And we've spoken about it before, but I really think it does bear repeating and maybe further examination. Remember, Paul has just come off of this discussion of who is Israel, right? In Romans 9 through 11. And really, the entire book is this question of who is Israel. You get all the way back in this keynote verses in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 1, where he says, hey, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Because, you know, there in it is the righteousness of God, right? That salvation is offered for everybody who believes, both the Jew and the Greek or the Gentile. Okay, so he's saying that God is, he's calling a people and he's making them righteous. And it's on the basis of faith. And it doesn't matter if they're from a Jewish descent or a Gentile descent. And that's his keynote. Mm-hmm. Okay, and he doesn't divert, you know, he doesn't deviate from that at all. He doggedly develops that idea And chapters 9 through 11 are kind of the zenith of that development. Mm-hmm. It's not some sidebar. When we see it as a sidebar, what we have done is we've used Romans from a very individualistic mindset, and we've said, "Oh, this book is about how I'm personally saved," and mm-hmm. you know, and then, "Well, what's this stuff, you know, about Israel?" And yeah. then, "Oh, we're back to how I live out my salvation in chapter 12." Mm-hmm. And it's so individualistic that you know, we are so individualistic that we struggle. But this individualism is why we can't see what church is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why I go there for my kids.
Yeah.
You know, right. Why I select the church based on what it does for me, because I don't see that the plan is that God wants a community, a nation, right? And so if we were to see that, I think we would have the lenses to better understand Paul's idea of salvation, what is church, what we're called to be. So in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, "Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy." What mercy, right? He's just been speaking about God's mercy mm-hmm. in chapter 11, where God says, "I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy." Mm-hmm.
Jews and Gentiles, all who are called.
Right. And those who are the objects of God's mercy, according to Exodus, where, you know, what he's quoting there is, I think it's around Exodus 33, where Moses, you know, sees God, right? He sees where he's been. He has this encounter with God that I think is monumental for the Jewish faith, right? Their prophet had this in-person encounter with God, Moses, okay? And so, but God announces that I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. But this is all in this great drama that is the call of Israel out of Egypt as a nation. It is... This story in Exodus is the birth of a nation, not just God being nice to some individuals.
Right.
Right. And so when Paul cites that, he really quotes God in that, you know, God says, "I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy." Mm-hmm. This is a proclamation that, you know, those who are the people of God are the people who are under God's mercy. They are uniquely under his mercy. Okay. And Paul has made the point that everybody who has the faith of Christ is under God's mercy. They are Israel. Okay. And now he says, in view of God's mercy. Mm-hmm. So chapter 12 is about how to live as Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's not
as God's chosen people.
Right. It's not just resuming back there in chapter 8 when you were thinking that was about you as an individual. He's just been speaking about God's mercy. He's been using that word in chapter 11. It's got to be what he's referring back to. Mm-hmm. And so another problem that we have in English is we don't have a plural second person, and we struggle to know.
Yeah. We don't, the y'all, the you right. all.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so this is really addressed to y'all. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he's saying, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, if you just said that Israel is the physical Israel, the worship cult of Israel was provisional, and that God's plan for Israel is realized through the gospel. Okay. You just said that. How are you replacing everything that's gone now? You know
what takes its place,
right?
The worship. What takes the place of the worship cult of Israel,
right? Okay. Right, and so that's what he's addressing, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. not just how you should live personally.
Right, right. He's laying the foundation for the churches that is Israel. He has said Christ has replaced the cult, mm-hmm. worship cult. What Christ has accomplished replaces the worship cult.
Yeah,
the Levitical system.
Right,
and now what are we to do as our worship, since we are called out to worship God?
Right, okay. Right. And so he says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. In the Greek there, it has to do with something that is according to reason. It could mean it's spiritual, or it can mean reasonable. It's logikos, okay? And so we struggle to correctly translate that. I don't know if anybody has a good translation for that. This adjective for the worship. This mm-hmm. is the worship that I would say it's a reasonable worship in that it's the most logical response to a God who's given himself for us, right? But it's also a spiritual kind of worship. It's not, you know, it's logical, or it is intellectual in the sense of in contrast to something that is menial, okay, or mundane. Like it has to do with bringing worship into, bringing a spiritual overlay onto ordinary life. Okay, so how do I offer my body as a living sacrifice? Does that mean like for 15 minutes a day? You know, what does it look like to offer my body as a living sacrifice? And I really think that he unpacks what he's saying. Okay, so the first thing that he's saying is that you need to offer your body as a living sacrifice, pleasing to God. Okay, so really, if we look at verses 1 and 2 as a tandem pair, okay, and I think that this is him introducing this section of how to live as Israel, okay, as a group, not just as an individual. I think Romans 12, 1 and 2, the rubber meets the road, and everything he's been saying leads up to this point of how to live as Israel. And chapters 12 through the early part of 15 are the practical outworking of those things, okay? Right. So if you really want to know how to be church, not how to join church, okay? And I don't know that anybody does. Maybe there are, you know, there are some. But the mass of people in America today have been offered an alternative that's much more palatable, and that they're happy with it. And so if they are, I don't know how that we can, you know, talk them off of that, except that it's not God's plan. He doesn't want that. You know, I mean, if that really matters, you should probably pay attention and, you know, and think about how else to be. Okay. And so he's being very, very practical, very clear in these next few next three chapters, next several verses about how to be Israel. Okay. And there are two major headings for how to be Israel, because God's plan for Israel is twofold. Remember, we said it's a kingdom of priests and it's a holy nation. God could That's have from just the Old said Testament. A kingdom of, right. And in Exodus 19, God could have just said, I've called you to be a kingdom of priests. That evokes this idea of the body politic, of how we live with each other, how we share our unique offerings and roles in our society as a kingdom. And it speaks to the purpose of those offerings as worship to God, a priesthood. Okay. Why go on and say, and you're a holy nation? That evokes the same kinds of things, right? You're a religious, you're devoted to God, you're set apart to God, holy nation, body politic, right? So that's like he's saying the same thing, but he's just flipped it, you know, or something. Like, what's going on? I think that there's a twofold emphasis or focus in saying a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Okay? That the kingdom of priests has a Godward focus. And so he says, offer your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God.
Okay.
Okay. Then he says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is. Okay. His good and pleasing and perfect will.
Okay.
There's the word pleasing again. Who does God's will please? Right? Of course it pleases God. That's not what he's saying. You know, who are we proving God's will to? You know, this idea of test and prove something where you have to, in order to determine whether a metal is pure, you have to test it and thereby prove it. That's the idea, okay? He's saying that you need to manifest that God's will is pleasing to somebody. Now, God's will is obviously pleasing to him, just like my will is pleasing to me, right? He's really saying that the world is going to see that God's way is right. And so pleasing unto God, pleasing to a watching world. Kingdom of priests.
Kingdom of priests, holy nation.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's the twofold emphasis of that's kind of woven together in these next several verses. So he takes them in turn at first. Okay. In chapter 12, he talks about how to live as a kingdom of priests pleasing to God. Remember, we offer our bodies. Okay. What does it look like for somebody to offer their body? For me, I've always said, you know, I'll have a devotional time and pray, God, I'm here, I'm available, you know.
My whole life is yours, God.
Right.
You know, do what you want with me.
Right.
I'll follow you wherever you lead.
Right.
Okay.
And that really doesn't really ever go anywhere. At least it didn't for me, and maybe I'm just more good intention than good action. But it's just not a very practical thing to say as like personal devotion. Like, I'm just going to start writing checks that maybe I can't cash, you know. But I think that he gets really specific because he returns to this idea of body, right? Offer your bodies a living sacrifice, for just as each of us has a body with many members, and these members do not all have the same function, verse 4, so it is in Christ. Though many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others, we have different gifts according to the grace given to each of us. If your gift is prophesying, then prophesy in accordance with your gift, with your faith. If it is serving, then serve. If it is teaching, then teach. If it is to encourage, then give encouragement. If it is giving, then give generously. If it is to lead, do it diligently. If it is to show mercy, do it cheerfully. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love.
Mm-hmm. So if he says, as a header, offer your bodies as a spiritual worship, then immediately runs into offer your gifts to one another.
Right.
It's pretty clear that he's talking, when he says offer your bodies, he's talking about community life.
Yes.
Mutual love in community.
Right. Cast your body into the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it practically through just giving your gifts. So, you know, now these offerings become this very practical thing woven into the community. And so this kingdom is essential to the priesthood. Like, we can't fulfill our priesthood if we are not in a specialized physical organization of people.
A priest makes sacrifices to God.
Right.
And how we make our sacrifices to God is by serving, doing our part in the kingdom.
Right.
In the church. This kingdom, in this kingdom of priests.
Right. Exactly. And so this becomes, and I think this is what God really wanted from Israel. I mean, time and again, it's like the onlooking world is going to see that these laws are just, you know, that people are treating each other well, that the stranger and the foreigner find a welcome and shelter here, that, you know, you don't harvest the corners of your fields, and, you know, simple stuff like that, that just allows for mitigation of suffering and care for the poor. And this is what the laws specifically in Israel were meant to do. But now we don't need prescriptive law. What we have is this internal calling to mutual love through faith, right? And so he's just saying, man, you know, whatever God has called you to do, whatever gifts you have, point them at your brother. This is your spiritual sacrifice, your worship. And then, you know, he gets on into these other things like, don't repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. What's the other direction we're supposed to be?
Oh, yeah. Holy going? Nation. Like pleasing to people.
Pleasing to people. Mm-hmm. What is he saying here? Do what is right.
In the eyes of everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Obey the law. Obey the authorities.
Mm-hmm. He goes and right into you will that in chapter 13.
Receive praise from the same. Mm-hmm.
Is that in chapter 13?
Chapter 13.
Right, so now you're in 13 where he's talking about, sort of the external world.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Be a holy nation. You as a society, you as a people among the peoples, among the nations, that, you know, if you live in this way, that you're aware of the reputation of your group, that, you know, hey, people are going to hate you, they're going to mistreat you. You respond to them in a way because, you remember, he said, you need a renewed mind to do this in verse 2. Don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Now, he gets down to verse 12, and he says, do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath, as it is written, it is mine to avenge. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Mm-hmm. You know, we read verse 2 and we think, what does it mean to get a renewed mind? You know, I need to have a regular devotion time. I've got to read the Bible a lot. Maybe I've, you know, or whatever it is. Again, it's just so individualistic and it's ripped out of the context. He's clearly saying that the mind shift is how you respond to people who mistreat you.
Mm-hmm. You know? Which does come out of taking to heart the gospel. This is how Christ responded to his enemies. He said, Father, forgive them. You know, so there is a personal application to the gospel and in your mind.
Right.
But it has to do with how you're going to treat people in mm-hmm. the real world.
Right. Which, you know, gets back to, since this is an election year, it gets back to this, this teaching, I think, in Romans 12, it indicts the sectarian approach that Christians take in our society. When Christians are seen as a political bloc advocating for their own themselves and their own position on things, that's not the renewed mind. That's the old mind. Mm-hmm. That's the you're going to oppose me. Well, I'm going to oppose you. You know, you're going to advocate for yourself. Well, I'm going to advocate for me. You know, you're going to amass enough numbers. You're going to exert pressure. So am I. You know. That is not a holy nation. That's a profane nation.
It's using the ways of the world, maneuvering, and to get our way, to accomplish what we want,
right?
And what is good for us, rather than seeking what's good for others.
And it's not do good to those who hurt you, right? Mm-hmm. It's not bless those who curse you. It's curse them right back. But the troubling thing is that the instinct to do that, it comes from an unrenewed mind. Mm-hmm. And so
we'll
be over here having devotions and all of that and accountability groups. But while we're there, we're talking about the libtards, right? Mm-hmm. Or whoever it is that we disagree with, mm-hmm. where this vision of church is where you've got people all over the spectrum who are part of your most intimate group. You know, people who they differ with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're in your group.
Right.
So you don't, you know, if you sit around and you start talking about somebody across the sectarian divide, well, guess who's in the room with you? You know, it's self-correcting. Mm-hmm. I think as a kingdom of priests that there is this call to what is diverse. You know, so you get over into Romans 14, he resumes this. You know, he talks about how to live in a group of people who are by design very different from each other, not despite their differences, but because of them. Mm-hmm. And so we really are beginning to do away with what divides most of humanity. We become something unique in that we believe in Christ and we live at this echelon that is very different. We don't get involved in the muck, right? We don't participate in it. I mean, I've got my opinions politically and in other ways. You know, I'm pretty clear on what they are. At the same time, I don't feel like everybody who agrees with me is right and everybody who disagrees with me is wrong, or that the good people are in my camp and the bad people are in the other camp. Mm-hmm. And that if you vote for somebody else or you have a different view on some political matter, you're just as much my brother as somebody who agrees with me nearly 100%, that there's really no distinction. And at the same time, I really think that we as the Christian group should not be seen as those, at least solely as those who are just advocating for political positions or some agenda, but those who are giving high priority to caring for those. You know, as a group, we should be seen as those who are promoting the well-being of our society, regardless of who's in it. You know, our larger society. It's like we are exiles in this surrounding culture, okay? But Jeremiah and Jeremiah 29, you know, we have a great depiction of what it's like to be an exilic nation. And he says, pray for the the peace of the city that you're a part of, you know? We need to be those who are advocating for the well-being of our neighbors, though they disagree with us, then, and really even coming together and leveraging our collective energies for the good, you know? But even when we do some sort of an outreach, it's almost like a political thing or a PR stunt, because we just want, you know, to get people over on our side of the fence, rather than just making the society we're a part of better. You know, that we should be eliciting praise, you know?
And that's what a holy nation would do.
Right. Yeah, I think that, you know, I always read Romans 13 and I just didn't understand where he's saying, obey the authorities and you'll receive praise of the same. And I just had this picture of, you know, a cop pulling you over and telling you, you know, you did such a great job back there. You know, I was clocking you and you were going the speed limit and I just wanted to tell you thanks, you know, keep going. And that just never happens, does right. it? You know, yeah. But what I think what does happen is if we as a collective are bringing the fruit, the overflow of this kingdom of grace into our neighborhoods and our cities, so that people are like, you know, I don't know who those people are, but I'm glad they're here. You know, they just cleaned up that park, you know, or whatever. But they're seen as people who contribute to the well-being. They're not troublemakers. Mm-hmm. They aren't making life hard for those around them. And I think sometimes, you know, if it, let's say you're you're in a church that's pretty robust and there's a bunch of bars, you know, on this particular street, and you lobby for, you know, some sort of restriction on the availability of alcohol as a group, you know, and you have good intentions, but people don't, you know, they don't see you as their friend at that point, you know, right. The business owners, the people who are finding solace in the bottom of a bottle or whatever. I mean, yeah, if maybe if it's restricted, maybe life will get better, you know. But what if, you know, what if instead you provide, you know, a place for young people to connect that is positive, you know, and you invest in education initiatives. You know, that the problem is largely that in this society that you're in, the problem is hopelessness, you know, that these bars are thriving because it's just people are hopeless. So instead of trying to force people, you know, to stock up on extra booze on Saturday night so they don't, because they know they can't buy it on Sunday morning because you wanted some law passed, you just made their life harder. I mean, they're getting exactly the same place, but it's just harder for them. Why would you do that? You know, but instead you're working to bring hope in real ways in the society. And so people are like, they just don't need that. You know, you're promoting healthy families and maybe you're investing in the economy in some way. Maybe you do have somebody that's well-to-do and, you know, they could make more money by moving their manufacturing overseas, but they're a believer in Christ. And they're like, you know, I'm not going to sell as many units, but I really want to invest in this town. I'm moving my factory here. You know, and hey, I just love Jesus and I love you and I want you to do well, you know? Yeah. You know, there could be lots of things. I'm just saying that if our goal as a holy nation is to participate in just the common well-being, and I really do think that that's the call when Paul says, you know, submit yourself to the authorities because they are ministers for good. You know, there's just general good. There's just general flourishing and well-being that we as a group can participate in. Not try to force your congressman to ban access to things that you don't believe in. You're making somebody's life harder. You're being more sectarian, you know? Anyway, I really do think that if we could embrace church as the kingdom of priests, the holy nation, what we're looking for is, instead of asking, what are they providing for me? We're asking, where can I bring my gifts?
Yeah.
And I hope that that's what people will ask. That that they really want to, and I hope that, you know, we really look seriously at what gifts we have, you know.
And be humble about it and not be self-promoting, but actually looking to serve and to contribute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's a great talk about church. Thanks, Nathan. Folks may want to chime in on that. You can always email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.